Hello, and welcome to another episode of Alec Mappa Hot Mess with Matthew Dempsey, psychotherapist. I'm Alec Mappa. Welcome to the Mental Health Podcast, where we talk about mental health so you don't have to.
And I'm Matthew Dempsey. I'm a multicultural counselor and psychotherapist, and so happy to be here with you, Alec.
Do you find that people are talking about mental health more now?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, people are definitely talking way more about mental health. I feel like it's been, especially because of social media, people are talking about it way more in general. And then the last couple of years, because of the pandemic, you know, people are feeling things a lot more and needing more mental health support.
I think there's more of a sense with of it being more of a necessity. I think before it was kind of viewed as a luxury.
Right.
And I think this is where I'd like to see it go in the culture, where people are taking care of their mental health like the way they go to the dentist. You know, I gotta get this checked out, you know, instead of waiting till there's a tooth rotting in your head, you know, you kind of address it while it's happening.
I would love to see it be just as normalized as physical education in schools, right? Like, why don't we have a, you know, mental health ed in schools and kind of learning about that in the same way that we're learning about taking care of our bodies as we get older through, you know,
the Did you have a counselor at school, a school counselor that you were sent to occasionally?
But like school counselors, most of the time it really just kind of amounted to like, you know, having to like deal with conflict. If you got into a fight with somebody at school, it really wasn't something that promoted kids going in to talk about the issues that they were dealing with. So, I just wish that like that would be much more normalized. And I think that we're on our path. On a path to that now.
Yeah. I mean, I just had a career counselor who said, all right, we got your questionnaire that you want to be a morgue cosmetician. Very funny. Cause I put that down and then they would say things like, you really need to apply yourself, but it wasn't like any kind of mental health thing.
Yeah. How old were you the first time that you ever went into therapy?
I went into a therapist. I should have been going regularly, but I went to a really low-end counseling service when I was at NYU.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I was like 19, but it wasn't like somebody dedicated just to me. I didn't start doing that until like my 40s.
Oh, okay. All right. What made it low-end at school at NYU?
I don't know. I feel like it was kind of like a drop-in center. What's bothering you? As opposed to like, let's go there. Let's take this apart. I mean, because to me, the benefit in therapy for me is always in that when you say what you're worried about out loud and somebody goes, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not that big a deal. That makes sense.
100%. Yes.
You know, because you're walking, I'd be walking around thinking I'm too extreme. Yeah. I'm making too big a deal out of things.
Yes.
And then also kind of like, you know, I think it's the only way to kind of really explore your choices.
Yeah.
Therapy, I mean, like, you know, your life choices. What am I doing? Who am I hanging out with, et cetera, and so forth.
Yeah, but it's hard to navigate those things and to understand how we feel along the way of navigating those things if we're automatically judging how we're feeling. Because then that compounds how we feel. And then we kind of spin in that and we feel like we're crazy. We feel like we're too much.
Yeah.
We feel,
yeah.
You know,
well,
it makes it
I'm
harder.
I'm gay, so I'm immediately judgmental about everything.
As you should be. Yeah.
Well, we're talking about something that you and I are both familiar with today.
Yes.
And we have an incredible guest. We have Raven from RuPaul's Drag Race, who's one of my favorites, who now has their own show on Wow Presents Plus. And I found out this morning that it's already been renewed for season 2.
Yay.
So she's an Emmy winner. She's an amazing queen, an amazing person. And we're talking about people pleasing, which is something you and I discuss a whole lot, because you say that that's a trap that a lot of queer kids get into.
A lot of queer kids, and a lot of people in general. But yeah, it's really easy. And especially like therapists, if you're a therapist, you probably are a professional people pleaser.
All right.
I've had a lot of training in that because we kind of like enter into a very specific caretaking profession, you know, so that can kind of, you know, originate from that. But
is caretaking different from people pleasing? I think it is.
You think it's different? It's not the exact same thing, but there's for sure a lot of intersection there.
All right. Well, I'm a parent. I'm taking care of my son. I'm not in the people pleasing department as a parent.
Totally. Okay. So I should be more.
I'm the author of a lot of unpopular decisions.
But I should be more specific. That like to be kind of like a caretaker, like in more of like a codependent kind of way.
All right.
In a way where you feel as though that you have to take care of other people before your own needs get met first. Parenting is kind of like an exception to the rule in this way. But yeah.
So you think that the trap in caretaking, what I'm hearing, is when you feel like you have to, as opposed to wanting to.
Fully. Okay. So,
wasn't that a good question?
Yes. Well, it's all in the intention, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for example, like, you know, I grew up with certain adults in my life. I'm trying to be as vague as I can be about all this. Right. I grew up with with certain adults in my life. Certain adults in my life.
Okay.
That required a lot of taking care of, you know, kind of like walking on eggshells, having to, like, you know, make sure that everything's going to be okay, so-and-so doesn't get set off, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And so when you, right, exactly. So exactly. And you've talked about that.
I'll name names. Okay, my dad was horrible. I had to people please to clean up the mess.
And so when you have to do that, then what happens is, especially at a very young age, you learn not just kind of how to help other people, you know, feel supported. You learn that your value is in your ability to pacify people and situations.
Oh.
So you attach your value to that. Of course, that's not rational because our value isn't attached to what we do or how we can.
But you can end up doing that for years and years and years and years and not.
And so when you overvalue your ability to care for other people in a way also that you're doing that first so that you then can feel okay, then that's kind of fucked. And then that's what also helps to kind of perpetuate this like tendency to people please too, because it's constantly just trying to make sure, like, okay, I just want to make sure everybody's okay. It's okay. And you're talking about, you know, growing up gay or growing up queer. Yeah, for sure. Because when, you know, when we grow up, you know, feeling shame about who we are inherently kind of like at the core, then we try to do anything to just kind of keep people not looking too close.
I'm a good boy. I'm funny. And yes. I can make you laugh and tickle you. Like, also, that was the behavior that was modeled for me by my mother. Like, this was my mom passed away years and years ago. But this was something that was typical of her. We would say, Mom, are you hungry? And she's like, do you guys want to eat? Mm-hmm. And we'd be like, Mom, are you hungry? She says, well, if you guys want to eat. And it would be like, Mom, just say that you're hungry. But she had an issue with kind of putting her needs before anybody else.
First, I mean, that's effects of the patriarchy and misogyny, you know? And so women then kind of internalize this message too, that everybody else needs to be taken care of before they are. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I mean, it's almost Christmas time. Do you remember A Christmas Story, that movie? It was very much like, you know, my mom hasn't had a hot meal in, you know, 20 something years.
Or yeah.
Because she was constantly taking care of everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of boyfriend I used to be too.
Oh, really? Like,
what do you want? 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 Thinking that as soon as they get their needs taken care of, then I'm going to be.
Exactly. And that's when the intention is off, right? Because then, because it feels very much like, oh, well, I'm just being loving, right? Yeah, I'm being loving. So what's wrong with that?
The underlying message of that is you owe me.
You owe me. Exactly. It's strings attached. Love doesn't have strings attached. Love is a gift. You can give it without expecting something in return, because what we're talking about then, that's a barter, right? It's like, I'll do this for you so long as you love me in return.
Mm. Yeah. That's my family. it triggers me. Like when Jamie said, he's right here. He's like, well, I did the dishes. I'm like, don't barter with me. That's how my family operates.
Yeah.
I did the dishes. So you have to do everything for the rest of, you know, just like
gross.
Anyway, this is like such a loaded subject. And because we all have some people pleasing tendency. And what fascinates me is the people, and by people, I mean me, who go on doing it for years and have no idea.
Right.
And, and we're going to talk about that with Emmy Award winning drag superstar Raven after these important messages.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
We're really looking forward to talking to our guest today. You may know her from being the runner-up in season 2 of RuPaul's Drag Race and in season 1 of All Stars.
She is also an Emmy Award-winning makeup artist and is host of the new competition show Painted with Raven on WOW Presents Plus. In addition to Fashion Photo Review, please welcome to the show the fierce, the fabulous, the Emmy Award-winning Raven.
Yay!
Thank you for having me. It's been a long time coming.
It's been a long time, but you and I have known each other for a long time. Like, I met you before I had a kid. We met at Disneyland.
Yeah, we met, which is where I meet most people. But we met doing the Kingdom Party.
Yeah, you were dressed as Pocahontas.
And you were dressed as Aladdin, which now, of course, I know I'm not allowed to dress as Pocahontas
and
anymore.
I'm not allowed to dress as Aladdin. It is cultural appropriation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think, for you, Aladdin is a fictitious character, so I think that should be okay. But Pocahontas is a real person, a real Native woman, and that therefore I get it.
Having said that, Matthew, he was the most beautiful Pocahontas ever. Aww. You had that long Colors of the Wind wig. You had like a mini dress. You were all legs. And then you had those Lucite platform heels, which I don't believe were historically accurate. But,
you know, the thing is that I've always said that, you know, if you're going to give the illusion that you're barefoot, you should still have a heel on. And why not wear a clear one?
Yeah.
It looks like she's just floating through the forest. Like in this
with a Barbie foot.
Yeah, right. Barbie foot, exactly.
Now you're saying you're out in the Inland Empire. Is that where you grew up?
Well, I grew up in Victorville, so the high desert, which is just about 20 minutes up the Cajon Pass.
Wow.
It's halfway between your trip from LA to Vegas. Vegas.
Okay.
Oh. Okay. Yeah.
Now how is your family out there? How'd they come to be situated out there?
Well, my mother grew up there.
Okay.
And she was born and raised. My father moved there after he met her. He was born over in Russia.
Okay.
And then moved here when he was very, 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 like the picture of them coming off the plane. He's in my grandma's arms as a baby.
Oh, wow.
And then they lived in Chicago. So he's like a Chicago, like go Cubs, go Bears, go Blackhawks, all that. So then he moved here. After and met my mother because he was in the military, and they've stayed up there. I couldn't stay up there. I said I need to get out of it. It's stifling. There's nothing to do. It's not very fun. Everything closes early. And now when I've gone up there to visit, everything that was there from my childhood is now just gone. Even the Chuck E. Cheese that I used to frequent is now a Planned Parenthood.
Whoa.
You talk about
what a turn.
Yeah. It's
like, so it's, I used to be able to play skee ball here and now I can get an abortion.
Yeah. So if the only thing that would bring you back home would be a little bit of nostalgia, like that's not even there anymore.
No. And I love visiting my family and I love seeing my family, but it was that thing of driving through where I grew up and seeing the things that I used to do. And there's literally none of that. And it's not saying, there's no reason for me to go up there anymore.
No, right. But I get that. I get that because I grew up in San Francisco and every time I go back, you know, the geography is the same, but so much of the city, like, I used to eat at that restaurant is gone, or I used to play there, or I used to hang out there. All those things have been altered beyond recognition. You don't really recognize it anymore. So when you're growing up in Victorville, are there siblings?
Yes, I have four siblings.
Four siblings. And where are you?
Okay, so let me break this down.
Okay, break it down.
My mother and father married in 78. They had me in 79.
Okay.
Then a year later, they had my sister. 3 years later, they had my brother. Mm-hmm. Then they divorced.
Okay.
Then my mom remarried. My stepdad had 8 children.
Whoa.
And then my mom and stepdad had 2 more boys.
Oh, wow.
And then my dad had remarried. She had 2 children. They divorced. Then he remarried. She has 2 children. So there's like,
wow.
Yeah, there's a lot, but we were never in the same house at one time or in get togethers at the same time. But I say I have, you know, a very large family, and there's like divorce and there's been distance. I still have many brothers and sisters, and I have a couple that I still hold very dear, but my youngest 2 that were born of my mom and stepdad, Jose and Alfredo, they're my brothers. So growing up in the house, there were 5 of us, myself, my sister, and 3 younger brothers.
Oh, so you're the oldest of all those 5 then?
I am the eldest.
Okay. All right.
In your culture,
that was a lot of fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
In your culture and the way that you were brought up, are you kind of the boss? Are you in charge as the eldest sibling?
It was more my sister was in charge, to be quite honest. She was the one who ran the roost, and she kind of like cracked the whip. And she was also the one who was always ready to sit down in a court of law with our parents to battle it out, to make sure that things were fair, things were even, that
peacemaker.
You don't see things this
peacemaker,
but she was also not so much the peacemaker as she was, well, that's not right, you can't do that.
Okay. Oh,
we're not, I'm not letting you do this. So she was always
controlling,
kind of, but more of like contesting it and saying,
pointing out the injustices, it sounds like,
right,
kind of like, yes, wait a second.
Uh-huh.
A lot of black and white thinking, a lot of really just trying to kind of decipher what was right and wrong. Got it.
Yeah. And but we always had, you know, we had our family sit downs, our powwows, that we would hash things out. And a lot of times never came to an agreement. You just walked away and said, why did we just spend so many hours sitting here talking about nothing?
I kind of
love that, actually. Just, I mean, regardless of maybe how effective they have felt at times, the fact that your family still had the intention of getting together and trying to talk through things and trying to kind of sort through it is great. A lot of families don't even do that.
My family doesn't do that now.
Yeah.
Like we don't talk to each other. It's too late. It's too late to figure things out. So we're talking today about people pleasing and the roots of that and how it can be a trap that it falls into. When did you become aware of your own kind of people pleasing tendencies?
I know exactly when it happened. It was when I was 30 years old. There was something in me when I turned 30 that switched, where I stopped saying, okay, whatever you want. Okay, let's make this work. Me chasing after things and trying to make sure that, you know, why don't they want to be my friend anymore? Why aren't we speaking any longer? Why aren't we, me going, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? And I don't know why. I can remember, it wasn't like the minute I turned 30, I got this special power, but I remember it was when I turned 30 at that same time that I started to realize, you know what? Fuck all these people.
Yeah.
If you don't want to be part of this, or you don't want to get in the car and go for a ride, get out. The bus stop, like, it stops here.
Right.
And I remember, you know, even something as little as going to go do a show, and my friends still looking at it as me just getting dressed up and going to the club.
Mm.
And so when I would say, they would say, hey, I want to go to the show with you. And they would get there at 8:15, 8:30, 8:45. And we needed to leave by 8. And me sitting there constantly waiting for them to get in to get there.
Stewing in resentment and
I finally started to go, you know what? If you're not in the car by 8, I'm rolling out. And I've left people who pulled up to my house and rolled out because why? You weren't in the car. And it was even little things like that where I realized, why are you still doing this? You're in turn making yourself late to your job because your friends wanted to go with, it was little things like that.
Well, I like that you call it like a superpower, because it kind of is, when you can start to feel more empowered for yourself, not having to rely on other people in order to feel okay. But so you said it was around 30 that's when it started to switch. What where do you think kind of in your life that you could see how it started to develop that, that tendency to put other people's needs ahead of your own, take care of other people? Is there anything there that stands out to you?
Well, I would say that it was, you know, the failed relationships that I had as far as like, you know, romantic relationships I would be in a relationship and I was always trying to make sure they were happy. Mm-hmm. Right. I was not happy. It didn't matter if I was or not. I wanted to make sure they were. I had gone through a couple of relationships that were kind of, I don't want to say back to back to back, but they were very close. And I remember the last one just before this triggered that, and it was a year to the date that we had started seeing each other. And I was like, I don't like you. you need to leave. Like, I don't want to go out and do anything. I don't like you.
Right.
And
right.
I kind of went, oh my gosh, I just said that.
Yeah.
Like, no, you can do this and you should do this, because then you end up sitting there in these relationships and these, whatever type of relationship they may be, where you go, oh my gosh, and there's years spent, and then it's resentment of you wasted all this time with someone that didn't bring nothing to the table.
Isn't thinking of me, isn't putting my needs first, isn't kind of like, isn't collaborating with me.
Yes.
Because that's what I found out. Yeah, there's a chapter in The Artist's Way where they talk about crazy makers. A certain type of person who like takes up all of your time. Oof. And I feel like after my mother died, similar to the change that you talked about at 30, where all of a sudden I would not make time for people who took up all of my time and contributed none of theirs.
Yeah.
You know, the person who's like, take me to the airport or help me move all the shit out of my closet.
Yeah.
Like, no, I don't really want to do that today.
People that monopolize all of your time and really don't kind of don't offer anything back. I think even it's so relatable, though, even when it's not that kind of person, when it's not like a toxic, you know, relationship or an imbalance in that way. How often is it that you're like, oh my God, am I okay? Or like, did I do anything wrong? Are people happy with me? Are my friends okay? Do people like me? It's like easy to get lost in that. And when you actually take a moment to think like, wait, what the fuck? Do I want to hang out with them? Like, do I actually want to spend time with them? And you start to realize I'm not even asking myself that question. And so like when you do, then that's kind of more of like an empowering moment.
It's like all the relationships we have with people we don't even like.
Right.
It's like you were my boyfriend for a year and I can't stand you.
Yeah. Well, and then there are those people who do that to you. And there are times where, you know, I had someone do that to me where they just literally walked out and I was like, what the heck?
Right.
And I remember I spent a couple of months in this like funk where I was just eating Otter Pops and watching Golden Girls every day. And just like, and it was like, and
what's wrong with that?
Yeah, it sounds like a dream. Yeah. Oh, so you had a great couple months.
It was a wonderful diet. No, but then I realized, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And it was shortly after that, when I had been in the next relationship where I kind of just called it off, that I realized, don't do that anymore. Don't sit there and go, what did I do that was wrong? What did I do that? How could I have fixed this?
Yeah.
And I mean, don't be a complete asshole and think, oh, everything is everyone's problem.
That takes out accountability. Accountability is a part of everything.
Yeah.
But you do have to look at yourself and say, I'm not happy.
Okay.
For sure. Okay. So if you took it back even further than that, then kind of like, you know, I'll be like super cliche, annoying therapist on it and go back to kind of like family childhood stuff. Was there a role in your family that you played that kind of really lent itself to developing this tendency to just put everybody else ahead of your own needs?
You know, I would say that because growing up as a gay boy, that was in the 80s and 90s, where this was not something now I didn't live in a family that really tried to make gay sound very bad or say that it's wrong. I would hear things here and there, and in being in school you would hear people talk about it, so you kind of you pushed it back and said,
microaggressions.
And you turn the other way and say, no, you're not gay. And then you do everything you can to try and make sure that you're presenting as heterosexual as possible, even though everyone knew David is gay.
Right.
There's no hiding it. So I think that growing up, I was always trying to play this role for everyone to convince people that I was not gay, that I was going to live this heterosexual life. And I, you know, growing up Mormon, I was going to go on a mission and I was going to marry, I was going to have children and I was going to do this and I was going to do that. And so I feel that all of that was almost a burden that I carried, that when you do reach a certain breaking point, you say, you know what? Fuck all of it. I am gay. I'm not going to get married to a woman. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that. That slowly over time, just it's like a boil that festers, that it finally just says, you know, it's time to go.
Yeah. I've known, I've worked with, and also just personally known a lot of people from the Mormon community, a lot of gay, gay guys from the Mormon community. And I've always kind of gotten this sense, you can tell me if this is your experience too, that it was, it's almost kind of like the perfect shitstorm, where you grow up having this kind of like deep-rooted shame just about who you are, and also then kind of paired with a certain kind of ideology of like, you know, kind of projecting out a certain kind of positivity, like a very kind of toxically positive kind of perspective.
Everything's okay.
And I can be really pleasant and really, you know, whatever. So it's like, I can follow the rules. I can project that out. And then that's also really going to mask this thing that I don't really want people to see, because they'll be so pleased by what I can project out. So it becomes, you know, even a thicker kind of a wall or a mask for to wear. Was that your experience too?
Oh, absolutely. And there were a lot of people growing up that I also knew were gay, that were in the church, but they were that person where it was the, oh, look at me. And just putting on that show for everyone to make everyone think, oh, they're happy, they're in a good place. Everything is aligned. Their life is wonderful. And in the long run, those people have come out. Right. And some of those people, actually, one of them in particular married a family member. Mm-hmm. And I remember her coming to me and she said, I met this guy, he's so great. And she started describing him to me. And she was telling me how they would go rollerblading and they would do facial masks.
And you're like,
he wanted to do manicures and pedicures. And he loved Michael and Janet Jackson. And I said, girl, he sounds gay.
Yeah.
And then, slowly, as we keep talking about this, I'm like, girl, he is gay. And so then she comes to me months later and says they're engaged. And I said, girl, why are you doing this? You're married.
Yeah.
Like she, you know, for her, it was, oh, it's my best friend. It's a guy. Yeah, who
of
is,
course it is.
Yeah.
Who's wanting to do all of these things with me. But, you know, at the same time, they were still having a consummate relationship.
Yeah. Don't you feel like there's like generations of queer people who had marriages like that? Because that was the only option.
Oh, for sure. Like,
and there still are. An older man in Palm Springs who was married to a woman for more than 30 years.
Yeah.
And I asked him, why did you, he's in his 70s, late 70s now. And he goes, why'd you do that? He goes, because we did. It was just, and I said, what about being gay? He goes, I didn't think about it.
Yeah.
I didn't think about
and
it.
And it was like a luxury. Now I honestly feel that being out, I don't want to say out and loud and out and proud and running around, you know, as this boisterous gay man, but being able to be out now, I never thought when I was a little boy, I would be where I am now, doing what I do, talking about this now.
Yeah.
I thought it was always going to be in the back of my head and a shameful thing that I lived.
Right.
Yep.
That where you talk to someone who for 30 years lived in a lie because they were pleasing everyone else happy.
Yeah.
And it stems to your childhood and your family having this picture perfect idea for you and saying, this is what we want for you.
Right.
Like I was just talking to my dad yesterday. He came to visit and we were talking about education.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of was like, I know how, because my dad is an English teacher. He just retired this year.
All right.
And he wanted me to continue my education. He wanted me to go to college. And I said, look, Dad, at 18, I'm no longer your responsibility. I'm doing high school. I'm getting that diploma, but I'm out.
Yeah.
School is not for me.
Wow.
And I remember being that kid getting out of, you know, just getting through senior year. I mean, by the skin of my teeth, I barely graduated.
Yeah.
And he was, I could see he was a little upset, and he constantly talked about going to college and you should go to college. And so when he was here yesterday, I said, I didn't go to college, and look what
look
I
at my house.
Yes.
Look at my house. Yeah. Look at my Emmy award.
Go to college. Yeah. And yeah, look at these things that I have been able to acquire. And I went the direction I wanted to go.
Yeah.
I said, nope, I'm not. I want to create. I want to do things. I want to be able to do my own thing without having a piece of paper that says I am allowed to do this.
Right. Yeah.
Now, I will not look at the educated and say, oh, foo-foo on you, like whatever.
Right.
And
right.
Like, you know, but I didn't, the track and the path that I wanted in life didn't require that. And
your
I
path. Knew.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that real quick. Cause I've seen you perform. Sorry. I've seen you perform, and your character of Raven is so confident and so like the opposite of a people pleaser. Like you're very enigmatic on stage. Do you feel the way drag lined up in your life? Because it says you started talking about going to the club when you were 30 and having more professional obligations. Do you think that drag helped you line up more with what you really wanted?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When I started doing drag, I was 22 years old. And I remember being very inhibited. I didn't want to do it. I wanted to do it. I had always gone to drag shows and been like, oh my gosh, this looks fabulous. This looks beautiful. This looks amazing. But then I also knew that people who were drag queens would complain about how they couldn't find a boyfriend. Or I would hear guys saying that if I wanted to date a girl, I'd date a girl. There was this weird stigma behind being a drag queen that they lived for you on stage, but the minute you walked off stage, don't talk to him. Don't talk to him. That's a drag queen.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it kind of played another thing in the back of my head that made me think, oh, I shouldn't do it. I said, I want to do drag.
Yeah.
And so when I started doing drag, I felt very much like, no, this is my stage. This is my queendom. This is I'm going out. These people are pleasing me.
Right.
I'm not going to please them.
And
now I've also never been the queen to say, well, what's popular on the radio right now? Okay. Mm-hmm. Then I need to do it. You know, now there are some queens that are, and they do it well.
Right,
do what I want to do.
Yes.
I dress the way I want to dress. I do the music I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I will go out and present it to you the way I want to. We'll get into it.
I love that you're talking about specifically about what your intention is for doing what you're doing. That if you are, you know, focused on whether people are not going to like you because of what you're doing, or, you know, aren't going to vibe with whatever song choice you choose or whatever, it's kind of like, that's not your concern. Your concern is, what do I want to do that actually I light up when I do it, that I enjoy doing it? And when you're doing that, that's you filling up your own cup. And then anything else that you have to give and any kind of positive response or connection you can have from that is like icing on the cake, but you're like baking the cake yourself.
Yeah, but we've also learned in this show that also drag is so specific in its intentions and what the result is. It's like you break every social convention about masculinity, about the way you're supposed to be, the way you're supposed to present. You know, like you said, you know, there was a stigma doing drag.
It's
like, that's a toxic masculinity speaking out against any kind of feminized man. But you do that, you break all the rules, and then you're rewarded by the audience. You know, it changes you in that way.
At the end of the show, was like, oh, wow, I enjoyed that. And you may not have, you may have gone into it thinking, they're probably not going to get into it, whatever.
Yeah.
But then at the end of the night, you've got people coming up, what was that song that you did? Oh my gosh, I'm downloading that song. What was, you know, I loved all of these things that you say, oh, wow, I'm happy I came in tonight. I did my job and I went out on stage. But you're, you know, at the end of the night, you take it off. And you're still the same person. You just don't have that fierceness that kind of masks everything, that you feel like, you know, I am empowered by this. And it's like being a superhero.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right.
Have you had a situation? I always love hearing about that, right? When you kind of do exactly what feels right for you and then you're rewarded at the end. Have you ever had the situations where you did what felt exactly right for you and it just like fell flat? And like people weren't connecting and it didn't get the kind of warm reception that you loved.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. There have been plenty of times where I've done, I've done certain performances where I thought, oh, they are going to live for this. And then I remember getting dressed. And as I was getting dressed, like little things happened where a zipper didn't quite work, or I forgot something. And as I got ready and went out and did it, it just was not, people didn't like. And then it was like the little things that I look back and go, did the zipper break because someone was looking out and said, don't wear that. Don't do this number. Don't do, like, was it some weird, you know, force of nature saying, don't go out there and do that. But yeah, there have been plenty of times where that's happened. But then you go, well, I just won't do that again.
You learn on your feet. It's like stand up. The audience is always this unknown quotient. The last time I saw you was at Precinct, and you did that song that was by that singer who's I try to say goodbye.
What's her name? Macy Gray.
Macy Gray.
You did a Macy Gray number where you had an umbrella and it was raining, or a singer sounded like who was that? Who was that?
That's Moa, M-O, it's spelled M-O-A. It's called Raining in My Heart.
Yeah, I thought it was Macy Gray. She sounds like Macy Gray.
Now that you say that, she does sound like her.
And you came out as this Poirot character, almost like French mime, and you had the umbrella, and you had like a whole story, and the audience just ate it up. But I'd never heard the song before. I was like, and people just went bananas.
Well, you know, it's weird because with the whole Drag Race, moniker, where it's so-and-so from Drag Race, there are some queens that show up from Drag Race and think they can just get away with going out there and doing the least amount of work.
Right.
And then there are those who go out there and feel they need to spin across the stage and do everything. I like to give them a little bit of a happy medium. Yeah. I don't want to sweat, but I also don't want to go out there and just lay around, which I've done. But I also love doing that where it's something that no one's heard. And then they go, oh my gosh, I love it. And I don't think that it is because of they're going to love it because I'm from Drag Race.
Right. No,
because I'm from Drag Race, I need to go out there and show them why I was on Drag Race.
Yeah.
And that's where my mind has always been, where it's never been this complacency of, well, I made it onto the show. I can get by with just doing the bare minimum.
Right.
No, I have to show them why there was a reason I was even cast, and why I, you know, made it as far as I did. So to hear that the crowd went wild always makes me feel great, but to know that it's that I didn't just go in thinking, oh, well, they're going to love it.
Right. You didn't go in assuming. Now, but now you're known with the new show, Painted with Raven, and the Emmy Awards for working on Drag Race. Your reputation now precedes you as this master makeup artist. Now, I've seen your makeup up close, and it's incredible. It's always like, that's not your nose. Where did your nose go? Now, Matthew has never had his face fully beaten. Looking at Matthew's face now, what would make Matthew like a fierce queen? What could we do here?
Well, okay. Obviously we would want to block out the brows. The first thing I always want to do is block out the brow. Some queens shave them off. Uh-huh. I when I first started doing drag, I didn't know how to cover them. So I did tweeze the hell out of them, but we would, I always go in for the eye.
Okay. Block out the brows, and that gives them more space to like,
estate. Okay. We could go and give a nice, and you've got enough forehead where we could give you a nice arched brow, but you already have like a really nice nose. Like we could go in and contour that nose even more to where it just looks completely non-existent, almost like a rat's doll. Because who doesn't want that? I think for me, like,
well, let me just clarify real quick that it's not like I've avoided it because I have any kind of hang-ups about wearing makeup or anything like that. I've actually had a ton of makeup on my face. I've just never had a professional full beat.
I would like, when we eventually do this show live, if this ever becomes a live enterprise, I would want this to happen live on a show, and I would want Raven to do your makeup.
So you want to do the entire interview while getting painted?
Well, or maybe after, to see how. I'm just really curious about what Matthew would look like all dragged up.
See, and I always love going in and doing other people's makeup, because you do yours so often that it's kind of like, you know where the brush is going to fall. You know where it's going to, you know, the folds in the eyelid, so you know where you need to place things. And I always like to paint myself differently. There are times where you kind of are doing so many shows in a row that you know, okay, just stamp this face on and go.
Right.
But it's always fun to paint someone else, because then you think, okay, let me see what I can do to this person. Let me see how I can make them look. And most drag queens will paint someone and they look almost exactly like them.
I always know when you're doing RuPaul's makeup, but it's really specific. In fact, when you started doing RuPaul's makeup, I was like, that's Raven's handiwork.
I look back at the first run of that, of doing Ru's makeup, and I thought, I was just like, oh my gosh, this, because I didn't know how to paint for these, you know, lights that Ru's lit with, and how to like deepen everything up and make everything look a little better. So I was painting her like she looks in a makeup mirror. Mm-hmm. So when she stepped out in front of the light, it like everything got washed out. Mm. And I went, oh, okay, let me try and deepen that up now. So I always look back at that first run of season 9 and I go, I'm never going back there. But, you know, then a couple years later, we end up, the show ends up winning an Emmy Award for makeup, which was, because we won during, the lockdown, the pandemic.
Yeah.
COVID.
Yeah.
So we watched on a little computer in the office, and it was myself, two producers, Jen Fregoso, who is also on the makeup team, mm-hmm. and Rue was in there. And Curtis, who is doing Rue's wigs right now. And he, when we won, that it was like, oh my gosh. Yeah. And I have a little video of it that they recorded that we, that I'll save forever.
I love that.
Amazing.
I love that. David, I have to ask you a question. So I actually have some kind of like, you know, young people in my life who are just starting to kind of come into their own, into the awareness of their sexuality, and also kind of like a real love and passion for makeup and like just starting to do it, even if in their own households, they, you know, there's a little confusion about what that means for maybe young boys, that kind of stuff. What would be a message that you would give maybe some of those young gay boys who are just starting to explore and understand themselves, but also really being able to do that through like the art of makeup?
I say this, and I've said it since I can remember, makeup is for everyone. Mm. It doesn't matter your sexual orientation. It doesn't matter your gender. It doesn't matter your job. The color of your skin. Makeup is for everyone. Mm-hmm. I remember going to get food at a fast food place in the drive-thru. And I remember the girl opening the window to take our card and give us our food. And she was painted. I'm like eyeliner, mascara,
thick lashes, love that.
Highlight, contour. And I remember one of the people in the back goes, why is she wearing all that to serve burgers? And I remember turning around and going, because she can. Mm-hmm. She comes here to her fucking job and she takes her money and she goes and buys her makeup. And this is where she gets to wear it. She's presenting you with a beautiful face. I was so taken aback by it, because I thought, who are you to sit here and go, she's not allowed to wear that. Like she has to be behind a makeup counter.
Yeah.
And that's the same with boys. Who said this makeup was for women? Who said that because it's presented on women, and because when we see commercials or ads, it's always on women up until recently. Mm-hmm. Who says that? And I think drag, especially with drag queens, that said, screw your norms. Right. I want to wear this, and I'm not just going to wear the makeup. I'm also going to wear a wig, and I'm also going to wear jewelry, and I'm also going to wear nails. So for the young upstart makeup artist out there, whether you, what, however you identify, makeup is for everyone. And if you can get your hands on it, it doesn't matter how much you spend on it. I just don't steal it.
oh, I got to cross that off the to-do list.
Yeah, we've all been there. I remember being a kid in school and going to the market and even stealing hair dye. Because, right. I want to color my hair, but my parents won't buy it for me.
Shoplifting is a rite of passage.
It's exactly. And once you've been arrested for it, you've made it.
Lessons learned.
I say makeup is for everyone.
I love that. You know, we've had such a great time talking to you, and I could talk to you forever, but we've come to the end of the show. You've given us our hot message. Makeup is for everyone.
Makeup is for everyone.
I love seeing you out. I love the work that you do, and you've always been so sweet to my family. So thank you for that. Where can people find you on your socials?
Well, I only have an Instagram, and it's Raven_Hunty. ITS Raven_Hunty.
And of course,
I got rid of everything else because, again, like we were talking about, there was a point where I just needed to go, you know what?
Fuck
I'm
it.
Done with this.
Yeah.
I don't want to do this anymore. So, that's it.
And don't forget to watch Raven on Painted with Raven. Mm-hmm. Congratulations on being picked up for season 2 on Wow Presents Plus. We love you. Bye.
Yes.
We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Makeup's for everyone. Now I want to go out and shoplift, Matthew.
Yeah.
I want to go out and steal some Clinique colors or something. What's your hot message of the day?
Oh man. I guess I love that, the general message of, you know, when you find yourself getting judgmental about anything, whether it's of other people, makeup or otherwise, or if it's of yourself, of however people are expressing themselves or you're expressing, you feel yourself kind of like, you know, clenching and getting judgy, get curious. Don't even beat yourself up. Just get curious. Like, where did I learn that? Where does that come from? Why do I feel like that, you know, these things are okay and these things are not? And when we just start asking ourselves those questions, we can see how fucking, like, you know, how much bullshit is attached to it, like all the conditioning. And we can start letting that go. And if we start letting go of judging other people, then we also start letting go of judging ourselves. And we can all just, you know, be more accepting and step into, you know, the fullest expression of who we
are. Right. Because when you're pointing a finger at somebody, there are three pointing back.
Hello.
in keeping with Raven said, you know, in letting go of the people pleasing, the benefit of that, because you think for years and years and years, this is how I'm going to be loved. This is how, this is my place in the world. This is my job. When you let go of people pleasing, there's so much freedom on the other side of that.
Oh my God.
And then you could also really love people more authentically.
Yes.
When you're not trying to please them.
Yes.
Because pleasing somebody, it doesn't always necessarily mean doing what's best for them.
Mm-mm.
That's my hot message.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Thank you. Where can people find you on your socials, big boy?
You can find me on Instagram at MJDempseySyke. And that's it now.
Who's my big boy? Who's a big boy? You are. You're a big boy. Matt's a big boy. You can find me at Alec Mappa, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. You can find us both on Instagram at The Hot Mess Pod. We love hearing from you.
Yes.
We love talking about mental health. Mm-hmm. To take the stigma out of it. Get curious. Tune in next week. Don't forget to download and subscribe. Tune in next week. We'll have more Hot Mess Fun. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
This has been a Stage 29 podcast production. The podcast is executive produced by Patty Ciano, Laferne Cusack, and Stephanie Kaysen. Our audio editors are Jackson Ruff and Jonathan DeMatti. Callie Kelts is the social media producer. And a special thanks to the rest of our podcast crew, Rwani Horenige, William Cusack, Lisa Clark, Katie Brown, and Morgan Kaler.
This podcast has been produced by Stage 29 Productions for entertainment purposes only. The contents of this podcast does not constitute medical or professional advice, do not reflect the opinions of this company, any of its parent companies, affiliates, subsidiaries, promotional sponsors, or advertising agencies. The views expressed by the hosts and guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. For more information, please go to stage29.tv.